I think the vision is so simplistic and elegant that it was really easy for people to understand. You know, nature has rights, like humans have rights, and also people have a light bulb go off when you say it. Also, as corporations have rights, for better or worse. So I think it was the simplicity of the vision, the simple elegance of it.
Welcome to The Regeneration Will Be Funded. I'm your host, Matthew Monahan. And in this series, we're having conversations about regenerative finance, technology, and our living planet. How can we build an economy that's in service to life? Brought to you by Ma Earth. You can find all of our conversations at maearth.com. Thanks for joining us. Hello and welcome. Today's guest is Grant Wilson, Executive Director of Earth Law Center. And this conversation is all about rights of nature and the movement toward eco-centric law. Grant helps us by defining a lot of the key terminology in this space. In this discussion, we talk about things like the trend towards putting nature on the board, intersections with Web3 and DAOs, ocean and water rights, and Apple's recent messaging around Mother Earth in the corporate office. I really enjoyed this dialogue with Grant. Rights of Nature is so exciting. Let's dive right in with Grant Wilson. Today we are here with Grant Wilson. Grant is the Executive Director of Earth Law Center. Thanks for being here, Grant.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So what is Earth Law Center?
Earth Law Center is a nonprofit that works to give rights and a voice to nature and future generations, which don't currently have any legal status, by and large, in our legal systems.
Mm. How long have you been ED?
I've been ED about 3 years, and I've been at Earth Law Center over 10 years now. Mm. Basically went there straight out of law school, which 10 years ago was pretty unusual, but now lots of students learn about this stuff and try to get careers in this space, which is amazing.
Nice. And Earth Law Center has a very good reputation in the rights of nature movement. Can you describe a bit of the scale and size of the team and scope of the work?
Sure. Rights of Nature is definitely one of the flagship things we work on. It falls within this larger movement of Earth-centered law that also includes the rights of future generations and even human environmental rights, because we think humans are part of nature. So our environmental mm-hmm. rights should fall within laws for nature. Mm-hmm. But the rights of nature movement is basically that nature has rights just like humans do. Plain and simple. Currently, there's just one rights holder in most legal systems across the world, and that's humans. And then there's millions of species and ecosystems that are just property under the law. And we think that's not fair, nor is it right. We think that all species have rights because they exist. Once you recognize the rights of a species, there's all sorts of other things. That's the easy part almost. And then you have to think about how does this species or ecosystem engage in society? Should it be able to vote? Mm. How does it go to court? Who speaks for it? And these are all challenging legal questions that we have lawyers and policy advocates working on all the time, all over the world.
Mm. And it's commonly cited that rights of nature law has been enshrined, for example, in the Constitution of Ecuador as one of the first countries to bring this into the forefront. Before going deeper on rights of nature, I'm curious around this, like rights of future generations. Are there particular cases or similar examples, as have happened in the rights of nature movement, that you would point to where this is becoming practically manifest?
They're both growing precipitously, and I kind of think of them as the twin movements for voiceless entities, mm. one for nature and one for future generations that just don't have a voice in our government. And you can even think of future generations as including nature also. That movement is growing all over the world. I mean, we saw just in 2023, this year, the case in Montana for human environmental rights for present and future generations. And there was a case brought by Our Children's Trust, and this resulted in the invalidation of a climate change policy that disallowed you from considering climate impacts outside of Montana's borders. So that worked in practice. There's also a lot of movements to give future generations a voice and legal representation. For a long time, there's been an ombudsman or ombudsperson in Hungary who speaks for future generations. Wales has a whole office that represents future generations. And then at the United Nations, there's going to be a huge summit on the rights of future generations. And there's even a proposal to create a special envoy for future generations. So they would literally have a voice in the United Nations. And not just in this kind of like informal sense, yeah, we're going to represent the interests of future generations, but in this legalistic sense where, you know, whoever represents them has to speak for their best interests, just like a trustee has to, you know, represent the trust, or a legal guardian has to represent a child. So that's going to happen at the UN next year. And I actually hope that the year after that, to go back to rights of nature, something similar will happen where there'll be a proposal to give nature a voice at the United Nations. And I think that's actually possible.
So is it fair to say, after working on this for a decade, like, you're seeing the movement grow? How are you feeling? Like, is it feeling hopeful that we're making good progress? Is it feeling like not nearly enough? How does it compare to maybe your expectations?
I will say the first 6 or so years I worked on this, I was losing constantly. And it was horrible. We made a lot of headway in like building awareness and, you know, spreading understanding of the movement, and, you know, would get some kind of non-binding laws or resolutions on the books. But there was just kind of a greater hostility towards the idea from some governments, from businesses, from academics and so forth. And so I would say I lost constantly the first 6 years, which was exhausting, but we kept going. And, you know, I think the last 4, it's been, you know, maybe the last 5 years, it's been a total paradigm shift. And now rights of nature is inevitable, growing all over the world, recognized at some level of government in, you know, over 30 countries, nationally in 4 or 5, depending how you count. And there's some nuances there. And I think the reasons for that are a couple. One, there's been an amazing movement built around the rights of nature, and the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature and other movement builders. The UN Harmony with Nature Initiative as well are really to thank for that. And then just greater legal sophistication and understanding, and mainstream acceptance amongst lawyers and governments and judges and so forth, these like decision makers who hold the power. And their understanding that there are tools to give nature rights and a voice. And a lot of these slippery slope arguments that you hear a lot as a lawyer in this space, like, you give nature rights and, you know, you're going to get sued by like every bug in your house. And then the next thing you know, like, the river is going to, like, you know, own your property, and its rights are greater than your right. There's all these slippery slope arguments. But people have thought through all of those and said, actually, we can like work all of this out, and it's not as hard as we thought. And that understanding has gained more acceptance in the legal community. And we've just seen this massive proliferation the last 5 years, and it's been incredible.
And how would you sum up the rebuttal or response to kind of those slippery slope arguments? You know, like, does that mean we can't eat meat anymore because animals now have rights and, you know, we can't kill them to eat them? Or does it mean that, you know, we can't build our houses with trees anymore because the timber means taking down a tree? And what are the common ways to frame this?
Yeah, there's a lot to be said there. You know, one important thing is that the rights of nature movement is all about the overarching health of large interconnected systems. And so, you know, the health of the Amazon rainforest, the health of marine ecosystems, the oceans, the health of watersheds. And so, you know, if you look at the health of those systems, you can create metrics or ways of understanding if they're healthy or not, and then, you know, enforce those metrics. It's that approach of, you know, creating metrics of what healthy interconnected ecosystems are and restoring them to that state is very, very different than the status quo, in which normally we try to reduce or limit the degradation of ecosystems. That's kind of a defensive, like, try to hold the front lines type of approach. And, you know, we see with an Endangered Species Act, for example, it's like you're protecting the species when it's almost extinct. Which is very different than saying, you know, this species should be flourishing and part of this larger interconnected ecosystem. So I think by defining what the goal is here, and that's kind of the intersect of law and science, you know, the right that nature has to health, for example, and defining that makes it pretty easy to, you know, put that into place without, you know, saying, you know, you can't kill a bug or mosquito in your house or something. That's just not what we're talking about. Mm. Whether you kill an individual animal is more in the realm of animal rights, which is another movement that's really interesting. You know, another thing to say is that property rights come up pretty quickly when you create these new rights in nature frameworks, and people say, well, nature's property, and that's true. You know, humans are persons or rights-bearing entities, and nature is a thing, it's property, it's a resource. And so, you know, what about my property? Yeah, in the law, there's this understanding, at least in Eurocentric laws, that property owners have this bundle of sticks, and each stick is representative of a property right, and it could be a right to exclude someone from your property or a right to take resources from your property. Mm. But what if we added to that notions such as reciprocity or regeneration of the land? And it wouldn't be that different from what we have in a lot of ways, but it would require people to give back to nature. Just a really practical way that could play out is you could have a county or a state plan to create biodiversity corridors and migration pathways. Mm. And each landowner would be required to, you know, be part of this larger whole to restore some native biodiversity to their land to ensure species could migrate through their land. Mm. And it would be a slight inconvenience and something that would, you know, really show that we're giving back to nature without totally overturning the property rights system, as some people worry about.
Mm. Gotcha. Yeah, it's interesting when you said about, you know, what is the goal here? A recurring theme that I'm noticing in some of our conversations is this reframe from what has often characterized the environmental movement around less bad. You know, we're trying to do, you know, save those remaining, you know, few species or few endangered species, or, you know, decarbonize, and versus more of a positive vision of like, what are we trying to restore and regenerate and actually create for the future? So I want to ask you, you know, especially in those early years when it was just, you're constantly losing, and I mean, rights of nature was such a fringe idea then, most circles, like what kept you going? What was the vision and the insight of why this is so important and worthy to be working on?
I think the vision is so simplistic and elegant that it was really easy for people to understand. You know, nature has rights, like humans have rights, and also people have a light bulb go off when you say, also as corporations have rights, for better or worse. So I think it was the simplicity of the vision, the simple elegance of it. And then also just learning about people who created the theory before we put that into practice was really inspiring. So there's someone named Thomas Berry who came up with this idea of earth jurisprudence. And the whole idea is that our philosophy of law, that's what jurisprudence means, should be based on our interconnection with the earth and the understanding that we're just one small part of this larger earth community. Mm. And that was the theory. The theory was really sound and well-respected, but it was the application of that theory that was so hard, because you run into, you know, capitalism and nature as property and all these like overarching themes that are hard to overturn. So, you know, really being motivated to bring life to, you know, what some of these visionaries thought of before kept me going, I would say.
And you cited and mentioned Eurocentric law, and by implication, you know, maybe these frameworks aren't exactly the same in other customs and cultures. Can you share more about that?
For sure. And I use the term Eurocentric law instead of Western law because, you know, many indigenous peoples have always been in the West. So it's just a more accurate term. For sure, we're, you know, I'm constantly learning from, you know, indigenous wisdom and understandings. And, you know, those are often rooted in some of what I mentioned before, reciprocity, the idea that humans are stewards of nature, the idea that humans have a duty to give back to nature, the idea that, you know, rivers or fish or orcas are kin or relatives, and really the understanding that humans are part of nature because we are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to say that we're not nature is really a radical departure from what people have known since time immemorial. And so we're in this like tiny little window of you know, 500 years when we've just like totally gone off the rails. And it's easy to forget that, you know, right now is this radical system that we've created, and that, you know, for the rest of time, we've kind of had this greater harmony with nature. Mm. Interesting fact is that the Diné, which is the Navajo, were the first nation, because they're a nation, to codify rights of nature anywhere. In 2002, they codified in a document many of their indigenous beliefs and customs, and amongst those were the rights of nature.
I didn't know that.
And it was kind of quietly, you know, sitting there until I went to a conference and started talking about, you know, Ecuador is the first country, and someone called me out and they go, have you seen this document from 2002? And I hadn't, and it really made me realize, like, I have so much more learning to do, and we all do, and, you know, from indigenous peoples and cultures in particular, like, their wisdom is, everyone agrees, part of the answer to the environmental crisis.
Yeah, it makes for a nice story to be able to point to something and say this is the first, but depending on how far you look back and kind of what the parameters of how you're defining these things, it's not so simple, I guess. How do you feel about this word rights in this context as well? You know, I live in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and there's an acceptance, but I would call it, you know, a polite nudging from folks I speak with in the Maori community that, like, yeah, but rights is not really the preferred or ideal terminology to describe this because of the way it frames our relationship with nature. Mm. I'm curious what you think.
A lot to say there. I mean, the history of rights is rooted in colonialism, and, you know, in a lot of places, the original rights holders were, you know, white landowners. And then it slowly expanded, and then maybe included their wives, but they couldn't vote because, you know, their husband could vote for them. Then it slowly included, you know, indigenous peoples and black people and other races. And, you know, the history of rights is deeply rooted in colonialism, and it's hard to go to people who have been deprived of those rights recently. I mean, in the U.S., the last living former slave was thought to have been alive in the early 1970s. Like, it's not that long ago that these institutions existed. It's hard to say that, you know, rights is going to solve everything because it does have this negative history. On the other hand, it keeps expanding and the world gets better, and everyone agrees each time it expands, it's a good thing. So there's some tension there. And I think many indigenous communities in particular I work with see the value in, you know, this Eurocentric notion of who has rights and who doesn't, and you go to the court and you figure that out, and that's kind of what we do. But also see, you know, a lot, maybe more value even in this idea of responsibilities to nature, mm-hmm. which is, you know, more of an indigenous concept. And so there is a little tension there. You know, when we work at Earth Law Center with different, you know, governments or people or also indigenous partners, you know, try to learn what their goals are, and some see the value of, like, you know, we have these courts here now that deal in rights, and that's what we do. Let's do that for nature. We can do it fast. Mm. You can put three words in a law: nature has rights, and it changes everything. And that's, like, really powerful. It's easy almost. The harder work is to decolonize everything. And to me, that means, you know, really addressing if rights-based systems are the one that we need to live in harmony with nature to begin with.
Yeah, it sounds like when you peel the onion back, there's a lot of different questions and how deep to go. So I get the sense that, you know, you're just approaching it somewhat on a case-by-case basis, and strategically, both Earth Law Center, ELC, as well as the broader movement, it's very much a decentralized, you know, location by location, context by context type of movement. Is that a fair characterization?
That's a fair characterization. You know, I'd say more and more, I'm moving Earth Law Center towards a law firm that can provide you with really good legal advice on ecocentric law that's emerging all over the world. And if you come to us, you know, you can rely on us to not have an agenda per se, but to, you know, learn about what your goals are. You want to give rights to nature. You want to appoint an orca to your board. You want to have a lawsuit for the rights of future generations. Or maybe you want to codify your relationship with sacred lands and waters in some sort of document. And, you know, we provide that legal advice just like a good law firm for a corporation or anyone else.
Mm, yeah. And can you help me understand the distinctions between earth law and environmental law?
Sure. Earth law comes from this idea that I mentioned earlier of earth jurisprudence or earth-centered philosophies of law. And it's the body of law that is rooted in our interconnection with nature, and if implemented, could restore the planet to health. We include the fields rights of nature, rights of future generations, human environmental rights, the public trust doctrine, animal rights, indigenous legalities, guardianship of nature. So sort of the cutting edge of the law. Environmental laws were really created to permit or regulate the amount of pollution we can do, really to allow for the exploitation of nature with some limitations. I was a Clean Water Act lawyer for a long time, and there's great tools there to kind of prevent rivers from, you know, totally being destroyed. But if your goal is to create this vision of living in harmony with nature, it's just inadequate. And we know that because there's thousands of environmental laws and treaties all over the world, and there's, you know, hundreds more being passed every year. Yet we have this, you know, enormous biodiversity and climate crisis. So I think it's pretty clear just from that, that, you know, the current system doesn't work.
Can you go back to public trust doctrine? What is that?
Public trust doctrine is a legal theory that dates back, you know, hundreds of years, that understands that the government or anyone, a trustee, has a duty to protect something, the trust. And this might be, in modern context, in the environmental law context, the duty of a state government or even a federal government to protect water, air, soil, the atmosphere. And there's litigation over this where people have sued the government for saying you're failing in your duty as trustee to protect the trust, which is nature. Just like you might, you know, sue a trustee who's handling an estate or something for doing so negligently. And there was a big lawsuit just a couple of weeks ago against the state of Utah for failing to manage the Great Salt Lake in accordance with their public trust duties. And specifically, the state of Utah said, you know what? The lake needs to be at this certain level, a little over 4,000 feet, in order for it to be healthy, because if not, it gets too salty and everything dies in it and the food web collapses. And they said, you know, you came up with that number and that's your duty as trustee to protect the lake. And you can sue under that. And there's been success under that theory in the Mono Lake case and elsewhere. And there's lawsuits all over the world too for forcing governments to take climate change action based on their duty towards this trust, our trust.
One more terminology question for you. Ecocide, we hear a lot about that now. What is ecocide?
Ecocide is this amazing movement that's being run by Stop Ecocide International and many of their partners to criminalize the widespread and severe destruction of nature. Actually arose after the Vietnam War. There's all this use of Agent Orange and chemicals that were destroying ecosystems and causing these horrible health impacts in people. And they decided to criminalize ecocide, they called it, in the context of warfare only. And actually, at the International Criminal Court, ecocide is prohibited in a warfare context already. But now there's a movement to criminalize it in the context of like climate change and big environmental disasters outside of a warfare context. And countries are starting to adopt laws that say this. France did recently. Others in Europe are joining. Brazil introduced one recently. I just talked to Jojo Mehta, who directs the Stop Ecocide internationally. And she is just telling me all these governments everywhere are introducing these laws now. And it just creates a higher standard of accountability, and you know, and no one's immune from it. It could be a head of state, someone who runs a corporation, anyone. And you know, I think it could be a game changer against some of these high level, broad environmental threats.
Well, our mutual friend Austin Wade Smith told me that you're an encyclopedia of knowledge about this movement, and you certainly have not disappointed. I appreciate you, just helping us get some of those broad, you know, terms out on the table. And what I'm hearing is that there's a lot of different aspects to this wider movement and this consciousness shift to bring nature into the legal system in a way that is, you know, hopefully bringing us more towards a harmonious relationship with the rest of life and each other. And that the movement's picking up and growing, and that there's, you know, some positive signs, especially in recent years. I would love to maybe look forward a bit, and what's most exciting to you, and what are some of the new areas and edges you're exploring? You mentioned if you want to put an orca on the board of a company, what is that about?
Oh boy. Well, you know, my job as an earth lawyer, I call myself lawyer for the earth, is to think about how these concepts of ecocentrism, of our connection with nature, can manifest in all sorts of different areas of the law. And traditionally, there's been a lot of rights of nature stuff and rights of future generation stuff at like the constitutional level or statutory level. Like, let's enforce these rights in the court and like fight it out. Mm. But what if you like incorporated the idea that we're part of nature into, you know, property law, into contract law, into corporate law? And, you know, that's where we get to the idea of how do you give nature and future generations a voice in corporations in a way that's not greenwashing. But really, what if, you know, corporations were part of nature? And what if the first line of the corporate code in any place was, you know, corporations are nature? It's almost like Terminator 2, where the first Terminator, it was, you know, the bad one, and they reprogram it, and it's the good Terminator, and he's saving John Connor. That's my favorite movie. Nice. You know, what if we reimagine corporations as agents of good for the planet? And is that even legal in, you know, the heart of capitalism in the United States or other governments? And we actually worked with a pro bono legal team, as well as another group called Lawyers for Nature, to consult with a company in the United Kingdom called Faith in Nature. It's a natural products company. And they came to us and said, hey, we want to make nature our CEO. You're like earth lawyers. You can figure this out. And we're like, oh, that's kind of interesting. So we thought about it a lot and workshopped it. And, you know, we're like, oh, if nature's the CEO, they're going to have to make, you know, hundreds of little decisions every single day. And is that like, how's nature going to do that? If you give nature a voice through like a legal guardian or through a proxy, like, can they figure out what to do 100 times per day when like hardly anywhere does nature have a voice at all? And we said, you know what, like, cool idea. We think a better one for at this moment in time is a board member that is representative of nature, because they make a fewer number of high impact decisions compared to a CEO. So you can, you know, make two or three really important decisions instead of hundreds of little ones. And then we worked with the pro bono legal team and analyzed the UK legal system and said, okay, is this legal for someone to represent nature? Because what if that doesn't represent, you know, this their bottom line for a quarter or something? Would they kick them off the board? And it turns out, you know, in the UK, there's a duty for board members to promote the success of a company. And success can look at things like environmental impacts of the employees, and it can also look ahead generationally. And if you have a successful company generationally, in my mind, it just has to harmonize with the planet because of the crisis that we're in. It's just no question. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the giant corporate pro bono law firm agreed, and we rewrote their bylaws, rewrote their articles of association to say that nature would have a board seat. It would be represented by initially two proxies, one from Earth Law Center and one from the group Lawyers for Nature. And they go to board meetings and they have this legal fiduciary duty, like a trustee would, to represent nature's best interests. And they've, you know, spoken on its behalf for over a year now. And, you know, we're hoping to roll this out to more and more companies across the world, and also innovate like what Patagonia did to make nature a shareholder, which is another model. And there's all sorts of other ways to inject the DNA of nature into a company. And finally, I think it's important, and I would challenge any country out there that's interested in this space to create ecocentric law havens for companies, like a tax haven. If you're a company that wants, you know, orcas and the ocean on your board, or if you want nature to be a shareholder, you could go to this jurisdiction and do that, which I think is really exciting. This group Hub Culture made all their board members be the Atlantic Ocean, working with Earth Law Center, and they're in Bermuda. And there's a lot to be done here. Corporate law is like so open, and there's not as many rules as statutory law. If something's not banned, you can do it. So it's an exciting space.
Ecocentric law haven. I love it. I'm very excited about that. And I hope that all of the folks in New Zealand are listening. So just getting back to the way that this works of someone representing nature on the board of a company. How would best practice you go about finding the right person to do that? And how would that person go about kind of embodying that voice?
There's so much to think about for giving nature a voice. And you can think about it in, you know, governments that have done this, like with the Atrato River in Colombia, there's river guardians. With, you know, the Whanganui River, there's guardians. And then, you know, in a corporate context as well, or on a city council, I'm working in my own little town and pushing for the idea that, you know, the river in town should, the La Plata, the Animas River in La Plata County should get a seat on the city council. Yes. And who speaks for it, and how do you ensure they're saying the right thing? There's a couple of ways you can go about it. One, I really think it's important to appoint local guardians that are rooted in that ecosystem, that have shown they care for it, and maybe even ones that consider themselves to be part of the ecosystem in question. Mm-hmm. So for, you know, in the case of the Atrato River in Colombia, they appointed Riverside Afro-Colombian indigenous community members to serve as guardians of that river. And they were people who, you know, believed themselves to be part of this landscape in which they lived and were inseparable from it. So it was pretty natural for them to speak for it. Of course, they appointed the other half as members of the government. And that's, I think, being scared of losing control, maybe, to mm-hmm. giving nature, you know, full autonomy in some sort of political sense. But that was a political decision and not one in nature's best interest. So that's, you know, that's one thing. You can also train people. We're working on a program called the Dandelion Fellowship to train people on how to make decisions on behalf of nature, which, you know, is a blend of ethics and history and, you know, learning from indigenous cultures and science and so forth. And so you could, you know, literally be certified in it. Maybe there'd be like a college program one day, which I think would be cool. Like, you could go to college to be a mountain. I would do that. I would go back to school for that. So that's something. You can train people. You know, you can also do it like through metrics, which is like less like people making decisions and more like math. You know, if the impact of X decision is like negative in like this quantified way, then it's a no vote for that. A very simple illustration of that my friend Jonathan Keats, a philosopher at Earth Law Center, thought of is just if a salmon runs into a dam, like that's a no vote against the dam. Like that's pretty simple. And you can quantify things like that. So there's a lot of ways to go about it, but, you know, I think it's important just to get in the habit of doing it. Mm-hmm. Joe Biden appointed Monica Medina as the diplomat for plants of animals in the U.S. And it's like, you know, she has a lot of background in the environment, doesn't have a lot of background in how to speak for nature, but it's like going out there and speaking for plants and animals on behalf of the United States. And mm-hmm. just doing that is important. And just having the practice of trying your best with some guidelines and, you know, some enforceability and some transparency. But going out and trying your best, I think, is important. And we'll learn a lot more about how to make sure it's as high quality as possible as we go. Mm.
Yeah, it's once again, there's just a plurality of approaches for how do we represent voices of nature in all of these different contexts and configurations. It seems to me that another one of these areas that ELC has been working on more is around oceans and water rights. Can you speak more to that?
Sure. Oceans are an interesting place for the rights of nature movement, especially the high seas, because no one owns the high seas. So it's not like you have to mess with all this property law stuff. It's shared, part of the international community. Mm. So that's been a focus of ours. And actually just yesterday, the UNGA introduced into the UNGA from a coalition of countries, a declaration on the rights of the ocean, the Universal Declaration of Ocean Rights. And so that's at the General Assembly level for discussion. I think 30 some odd countries showed their support. And there could become a future where the United Nations says, yeah, the oceans have rights. Let's appoint guardians to protect its health and so forth. Again, getting back to the earlier issue of not everyone thinks, you know, everything should have rights. I think within that same framework, you can also promote the intrinsic value of nature and, you know, human responsibilities to the ocean as well. It doesn't have to just be rights. Mm. Aruba is considering a rights of nature constitutional amendment in Aruba. And this is like a small island nation. And so I think that could be kind of a new spot for ocean rights as well. And then in Panama, they just amended their constitution to recognize the rights of nature last year. And it was this young politician, Juan Diego Vasquez Gutierrez, who was like 25. He just like goes into the legislature in Panama, is like, we're doing rights of nature here. And he was working with this other young scientist named Callie Wielenter from the Leatherback Project. And she worked on the rights of nature law. And this other young politician ushered it through. Earth Law Center provided nerdy legal advice on the law to make it really strong and enforceable, and they passed it. And now they're implementing it with follow-up legislation on the rights of sea turtle populations, for example. So really saying, okay, we did this high-level law. We need to put it into place for all different sectors of the environment, including marine species. So that's really cool. Wow. And then with rivers, you know, rivers were kind of the first ecosystem to really capture the public's imagination on the rights of nature, with the rights of the Atrato River, the Ganges and Yamuna River in India, personhood for the Whanganui River in New Zealand, and so forth, rights for all rivers in Bangladesh. And the kind of the next big thing for rivers is, do we have to, under a rights of nature framework, do two things? One is establish ecological flows, minimum flows in rivers. I think, yes, they have a right to those flows. And the second is dam removal. Do we have to start removing, you know, the thousands of dams that are on major rivers all over the world because they have a right to flow freely? That's going to be, you know, fought in the courts, including in Ecuador, where there's a case coming up that might seek to remove a dam on the Dulce Pamba River because the river has a legal right to flow. That would be just one of, you know, dozens of cases in Ecuador that are winning in the courts on the rights of nature, including for rivers and other ecosystems. So a lot happening there.
Yeah. Wow. There's so much there. I'd love to double click on what you referenced, the momentum in Panama being somewhat led by young politicians, young lawyers, young scientists. What are you seeing in this next generation of leadership coming up?
The youth that I work with and that I know are so excited about the rights of nature and earth-centered law. You know, I've worked with probably 100 interns personally, and you know, if I fail in my work, one of them won't. One of my interns named Arman. I said, Arman, he's this really smart young kid, and he just, we both understood he'd be president one day. I'm like, Arman, you're going to be president one day. He's like, I know. I'm like, wow, you're so impressive. And I was like, can you just make like a little like rights of nature, like task force when you're president? And he's like, task force. He's like, I'm making a whole agency. I'm like, yes, Arman, which is awesome. And there's all these young people like that. Like if you talk to like youth who like have such a deep knowledge of nature and climate change and biodiversity loss and are so empowered to change the system. Mm. So I'm really encouraged by that. And, you know, I think it's easy to look ahead a couple years and feel discouraged, but if you look ahead 5 or 10, these people are all going to be in power. And in the rights of nature space, it's a lot of young leaders who are leading the way, as well as in other earth law spaces. That's why I spend a lot of my time on education too. I wrote a law school course book that is understandable by undergrad students as well on earth-centered law and trying to push it out there. It's being taught in the U.S., just got accepted into a school in Japan, which is cool. India, Israel, these sorts of places. So nice. Yeah, the youth are amazing.
What's the name of the book?
It's called Earth Law, Emerging Ecocentric Law, A Guide for Practitioners.
Mm. And I imagine you didn't have a text like that when you were in law school.
I did not, no. I had not heard of the rights of nature until I finished law school. And I think probably every law school, at least in the U.S., and maybe everyone anywhere at least touches on the rights of nature, even if it's just a short mention or a day of the class, as well as these other earth-centered legal paradigms that are emerging. It's just really becoming part of legal education, which is cool because lawyers need to, you know, figure out not just what the law is, but what it ought to be.
Mm. So it sounds like we're making tremendous progress. What are the big roadblocks and challenges that, you know, here in 2023 we currently face?
The rights of nature in particular is a rapidly growing movement. You know, it's still drastically under-resourced compared to like traditional conservation. So, you know, that's one roadblock. Mm. Implementation needs more work. You know, in the early days of the rights of nature, it was so hard. You had to fight for every little inch. And if you got something on the books, that was just like a miracle in and of itself. And then you get to the stage where you have to implement that, you know, throughout society. And there just haven't been the, you know, the resources and attention maybe to do that in as big a way as, you know, I would have hoped. But I think the next 5 years, we'll see a lot of that, especially as, like, I think we've grown from, you know, dozens to hundreds to thousands of professionals, you know, working actively in this space, which is really cool. Mm. So the implementation part, And then I think, you know, the idea of nature having rights in a court is one thing. And I think people can kind of accept that, like, okay, corporations do it. But then I think some of the stuff like giving nature a voice in political systems, like representation on city councils or, you know, on a national legislature, those sorts of things, will take another step to overcome public skepticism. But I think we have a lot of the tools ready to do that. And then also to figure out, you know, the elephant in the room, capitalism, like, can rights of nature and capitalism coexist or not? And if not, what are the bridges, you know, to understand we have the system that we have, that's the reality, but that we can move towards new systems. You know, you have to start poking holes and building bridges. And I think that's going to be challenging, but very important.
Can you say more about that? Like, what's your vision of where you think we should go, and how radical of the changes to capitalism do we need to get at to live sustainably on the planet?
A couple of things I'd like to point out. One is just the word value. And the word value is important because, you know, you look at the legal system, like the Delaware Corporate Code, and, you know, corporations have a duty to maximize shareholder value. And traditionally that's thought as like dollars, bottom line, price. But the IPBES recently released a report that found there's over 50 types of value. And you can talk about, you know, nature's intrinsic value. Can talk about the idea that humans are nature and like that's a value. And there's different ways to understand what value means besides like the bottom line dollar value. And if we can kind of inject that concept into, you know, some of the corporate codes, so, you know, corporations aren't these, you know, sociopathic machines as was described in that movie, The Corporation, that you have to maximize profit at the expense of all life no matter what, and there's nothing you can do about it or you'll be, you know, sued as a board member. If we can do that, I think that'll be really, really helpful. Actually, public benefit corporations are a really good in where they've pushed back against this notion that corporations, no matter what, have to maximize economic profit above all else, or at least at the exclusion of all else. So that gives me some hope. The other thing is this kind of tension between the idea of putting a price on nature and commodifying it, which can be important because then you can pour trillions of dollars into it in a way that, you know, corporations and governments understand because they need to understand what they're investing in. But the tension between that and then the intrinsic inherent value of nature that's non-monetary. There was a big meeting under the Biodiversity Treaty in Montreal last year, and they have this outcome document. It's called the Kunming Montreal Global Biodiversity Framework. And it's basically a roadmap for the global community for the next 10 years on how to address biodiversity loss. And it was a big deal. It comes with, they're trying to build up a $200 billion a year fund towards ecosystem restoration. And it has these competing narratives in there of like, let's like go all in on like the commodification of nature and use markets to protect it. And there's value there. And I understand that approach. And then it also says, let's recognize that there's different values of nature and that it has intrinsic value you can't put a price on. I'm trying really hard to figure out what's the overlap of those two things and how can you bring in some of the intrinsic value of nature into the piece that's more market-based, to understand we do live in a market system, but that we can be creative and think of ways to, you know, represent nature's intrinsic values within that system without totally jeopardizing it.
Yeah, that's been a tension that we've been exploring a lot. And I think that a lot of times we end up back at the framework that if we want to define markets that recognize value of nature in monetary terms, it's really important that we also use policy regulation as defining the limits of where those markets start and end, and that's really the dance that we need to get right, because if you give capitalism a metric to go chase, sometimes it will just go off the cliff. But in the absence of creating positive financial markets for nature, we currently have a system where nature is enmeshed in an economic system that's only valued for its destruction and for its death in many ways. And so, yeah, it is a an interesting tension of our times. Anything else that you want to respond to or share on that?
Just that there are some like creative ways to kind of mesh together ecocentrism and, you know, financial tools. I think things like, you know, a sovereign wealth fund for nature, where, you know, if you're spending money in some market and a percent goes into a sovereign wealth fund for nature, and then, you know, you get back to the guardianship thing, you can figure out ways that nature can spend that money for its own restoration. We're working with, you know, the Region Foundation on exploring some ideas like this through DAOs and blockchain. And just to give a simple example, you know, what if there was a DAO that had, you know, financial resources, and when water levels, like in the Great Salt Lake again, dropped below a certain point, it automatically purchased water rights from those willing to sell them, and it, you know, went back up to the level to achieve health. And that's kind of, you know, the idea that maybe nature can, you know, be an economic player in this system, again, while understanding that we do have to address some of the larger trends and challenges with, you know, the market in and of itself. You know, that's one thing. And I think there's a lot of innovation to be done there, which is exciting. And actually blockchain, I think, is really cool because we're kind of on like the cutting edge of the legal system. And I feel like, you know, blockchain is kind of on the cutting edge of, you know, the financial system. And so we're natural friends with each other.
And what else are you sensing in that space? I'd love to go deeper there.
In the blockchain space. Mm. Yeah. You know, I'm sensing that there's a lot of support for the rights of nature, and that, you know, maybe we understand that legislation takes a long time, and, you know, creating entire new like national laws that enable rights of nature to exist in all its manifestations take a very long time. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, things like blockchain can be fast and nimble, and there are fewer rules and restrictions for how things work. And so as we test some of these creative ideas, like what if nature had a bank account? What if nature like collected wealth? Like what if nature collected trillions of dollars and like spent it like in its own benefit in this like really unique, novel way that, you know, at least until legislation catches up, traditional systems might not be the best venue for that. And, you know, blockchain and cryptocurrency offers more creativity in how that works and functions, and then can show proof of concept in a ways where governments are like, wow, that's like that work, what you did just works. That's amazing. And then maybe, you know, down the road results in some more legislation. So yeah, you know, we're exploring that again with Region Foundation and others, just how do we innovate in this space and how do we give nature a voice in the economic system, you know, also while understanding, you know, economics alone won't solve it. And some of these things like nature's intrinsic value should be part of the picture.
Yeah, it gets me so excited because it just feels like the physical changes and the cultural and social and legal and everything, like they need to be so dramatic and so rapid, relatively speaking, that having a space that is so rich with experimentation and speed, like Web3, blockchain, and, you know, clearly a lot of really smart and talented people. It's still fairly niche in my experience of the communities that are thinking about this from a nature or ecocentric lens in that space. But like you said, I do think that there's real receptivity and kind of a natural tendency to be open to new ideas if you're working in that field already. So it sounds like you're exploring DAOs, you're exploring kind of the notion that, you know, nature can potentially have economic resources. Is there anything else that you would point to that are key ideas in the, let's call it Earth Law and Web3 or crypto intersection?
Yeah. I mean, there's just the general thought that it will take a long time to have legal guardians for all the ecosystems that do deserve a voice. And there are, you know, novel formulations that could be, there's something called a zero person LLC, which is an LLC where like no one's actually on it. So it kind of does its own thing based on the rules you define. Like that's one way where you can just create something and it runs. And then again, DAOs, where, you know, you can take two approaches. One, you put people on the DAO who have certain rules to act in nature's best interest. And, you know, I like to think that maybe you could have like a scientist, a lawyer, a poet who's lived in the ecosystem that they care about and written a book of poetry on it, a child. Like why are these people not better decision makers for nature than anyone else? You could put all those people on a DAO and create rules and they'd represent nature's interests and collect funds or wealth for it and spend it on its behalf. Or you could do the more like trigger mechanism I mentioned earlier, where, you know, you say if X happens, Y is the result, and that could happen through a DAO as well. So, you know, there's different ways to do it. I think we just, you know, kind of the next stage of the whole Earth Law, Rights of Nature movement is nature being incorporated into all sectors of our society. And it's, you know, it's law, it's finance, it's democracy, like, you know, how do rivers and forests and ecosystems vote? It's business, it's education, you know, how do we learn from nature? It's just everything. And it's going to take some like leaps of faith and kind of, you know, new ways of looking at things. But I think the result will be, you know, really exciting and cool. It gives me hope for the future.
Yeah. And you mentioned the movement being under-resourced relative to maybe traditional conservation. And a lot of our discussions are honing in on how under-resourced conservation is. So yeah, like where does funding for a lot of this work come from, and how do we increase the pool of resources, and where do those resources need to go to support this Earth Law, ecocentric law movement?
You know, funding is typically from foundations that probably have one person in the foundation who like loves the rights of nature and, you know, kind of convinces people to move in that direction, or that loves, you know, some other ecocentric law movement. Mm. That's where our funding mostly comes from anyway. Some individual donors, you know, a couple areas I'd like to see more funding in addition to like all the traditional places, you know, like foundations and major donors and stuff. I'd love to see companies or, you know, businesses or anyone have on retainer earth lawyers to like help them out. And like, you know, hey, we want to like do this, you know, give a forest like a veto power, like on all our issues involving paper products, or hey, we're a government. We're going to start giving nature a voice in our city council and pass rights of nature laws. And I think it'd be great to have on retainer lawyers and others with expertise in that space.
Yep.
I know personally like 200 lawyers who would love to do this work full time, and they have like such valuable knowledge, but there's just not quite a marketplace for it yet.
Right.
But I think there could be. So, you know, that's one space. And then I'm also optimistic that some of these international funds, like in the Global Biodiversity Framework, the $200 billion a year they're going for by 2030 is includes in this section of what they'll spend on Mother Earth-centric actions. So I do think pretty soon, like governments are like, hey, like we got 10 years and now we got 6 and 5, and we do need to try something that's a more drastic departure from the status quo. And, you know, maybe they'll start, you know, funding groups with expertise in this space as well. I know the big green groups like the Nature Conservancy, you know, regularly gets large governmental contracts for their expertise. And I'd love to see people with this more, you know, niche expertise in ecocentrism kind of get those same sorts of large contracts.
Yeah. Yeah, my intuitive sense is that it's coming. And when it comes, there will be probably too little capacity relative to the capital of just a reactionary, you know, oh my God, the biosphere is being torn apart. What do we do? Throw money at it. Last week, 2 weeks ago, Apple did this commercial, which felt like a threshold moment, featuring Mother Nature in the boardroom with CEO Tim Cook and others. And it was unique in that we haven't really seen a company like Apple bring this to the main stage. And I'm sure there's been a lot of critiques on all sides of the spectrum of that. What do you make of this?
A couple things. You know, one, we mentioned earlier that like we do have to move really, really quickly. And that's why like blockchain, for example, is interesting. Mm-hmm. I feel the same way about working with corporations. They move fast. If there's a new trend, they jump on it. They're agile compared to, you know, governments. And so, you know, I do have maybe a greater willingness and appreciation for the need to work with corporations and innovate there than maybe I did in my earlier years, where, you know, so I was more interested in like the laws and like enforcing things against the corporations rather than innovating within them. So, you know, I would be eager to work with like an Apple about, you know, how do we give nature a voice in your company in a way that's meaningful and so forth, or, you know, look at what Patagonia did with nature being a shareholder and so forth. The commercial itself, I think got some critique for being greenwashing. I think, you know, even our work with putting nature on board members has, I wouldn't say critique, but had some skepticism, like, are you just greenwashing? And, you know, what I would tell Apple if they said, hey, let's do this for real. And, you know, what I tell people who are skeptical is it all comes down to the legal frameworks that you draft. And, you know, we have a comprehensive package of, let's say, for board members, different levels of authority they can have. Maybe they can have veto power over all other board members. Maybe they have two votes. Maybe it's just one vote and they can get outvoted. You know, what's the safeguards for whoever speaks for nature? How do you ensure it's not just, you know, someone saying whatever they like? And you can put all these things into corporate documents that are enforceable, you know, upon the company. And so, you know, I'd love to talk to Apple and you know, look at their corporate documents and say, you know, what would an earth lawyer change in these things to make nature, you know, a meaningful part of your company, or to make your company part of nature, which is the ultimate goal.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a fascinating time to be a part of the movement. You're right at the heart of it. And yeah, just really appreciate the work you've been doing and continue to do, Grant. Are there any other topics, threads, questions I didn't ask, or things you'd like to cover?
Maybe I just quickly mention, for those living in the Pacific Northwest, it's just one place we're really excited about now. There's a campaign to recognize the rights of southern resident orcas there in Washington State, especially. And 7 towns and counties representing 10% of the population of the state of Washington have approved proclamations supporting the rights of southern resident orcas. And we're now going to the state level to try to go for a state bill saying that orcas have rights, which might result in things like, you know, removal of the lower Snake River dams, which environmentalists have been unable to achieve thus far to restore salmon populations. New rules to address vessel traffic, and maybe giving orcas a voice in the government. And that's one of various campaigns we have there, in addition to protecting the Elwha Forest, which is this amazing place in the Olympic Peninsula. So just a little plug for this campaign I'm excited about.
How do people
about.
Get behind it and support it?
There's a petition on the rights of southern resident orcas online. You can definitely sign that. If you live in Washington State or even Oregon, California, or you're with an indigenous government that has interests in orca rights or their, you know, intrinsic value in giving them a voice in some way, reach out. You know, we're looking to work with community members. And when it's proposed at the state level, show your support. Write a letter to the editor or anything else you can do to let people know you want this. You think orcas should be, you know, have rights and be part of the government just like humans are.
Grant Wilson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can learn more about Earth Law Center at earthlawcenter.org, where you can also make a donation. You might also be interested in our conversations with Natty Green from Global Alliance for Rights of Nature, Jojo Mehta from Stop Ecocide International, Aaron Matariki Carr from River, Jan Hania from Biome Trust, and Austin Wade Smith of Regen Foundation. You can find links in the show notes, all of these conversations and more available on our YouTube channel as well as maearth.com. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you on the next one.